Hi there. I'm Barbara Newman, the new editor of Speculum, a journal of medieval studies. Welcome to Speculum Spotlight, our quarterly podcast in collaboration with the Multicultural Middle Ages. Each episode is designed to bring you behind the scenes of an article in our current issue. This month's episode deals with the Medieval Academy's 2025 presidential address by Robin Fleming. It's also a sequel to our April conversation about burial archaeology in the early Middle Ages. Co-authors Robin Fleming, Sam Leggett, and Emma Smith have investigated an early 5th century cemetery in the English village of Alton on the edge of the South Downs in Hampshire. Using bioarchaeological evidence from bones and teeth, they're able to obtain remarkably precise findings about the diet of individuals buried at Alton, their state of health, and even the ages at which they migrated from wetland ecosystems to the drier territory of the South Downs. Despite the complete absence of texts from this period, an analysis of the Alton skeletons and grave goods enables us to challenge older grand narratives about barbarian invasions and the fall of the Roman Empire. Instead of military incursions or dramatic cultural change, the cemetery instead tells a tale of individual migration, shifts in the agricultural regime, and consequent food insecurity, with a sad preponderance of youthful deaths. The host and producer of this episode is Jonathan Correa Reyes, an assistant professor of English at Clemson University. John interviews two of the three co-authors, Robin Fleming, past president of the Medieval Academy of America, is a professor of history at Boston College. A former MacArthur Fellow, she has published several books on early medieval England, including, most recently, The Material Fall of Roman Britain, 300 to 525 CE. Dr. Sam Leggett is a lecturer in computational archaeology at the University of Edinburgh. She uses osteological and funerary evidence to investigate diet and mobility across Western Europe in the early Middle Ages. With their co-author, Emma Smith, Robin and Sam have written Rethinking Grand Narratives, Mobility, Diet, and Health in a Small Corner of Early Medieval Hampshire. You can read this article in the July 2025 issue of Speculum. For now, let's listen to their conversation.
Welcome, Robin. Welcome, Sam. It's great to have you with us. In this piece, you discuss three grand narratives about early medieval England that need to be reconsidered. So, to get us started, what is a grand narrative?
So I think as the historian, I think I'll take that question. I think Sam will be happy that I take that question. The grand narratives are very useful, right? We can't do without them in history, particularly those of us who teach, because you need a kind of big story to tell over the course of the semester or a year. Or for those of us who write books, you need a big story to tell across the trajectory of a book. So I'm not opposed to grand narratives, but I think there are a lot of grand narratives that we tell that don't necessarily match the evidence that we now have. We have new kinds of evidence coming to the fore that suggest to us that grand narratives that we depend on, which are written based on written evidence, are not correct. And so the big stories of the political fall of Rome or the barbarian invasions, so-called, are two of the grand narratives that we tell a lot in the classes that we teach. But I think that Sam and my work, along with other people's work, has shown that those two narratives really need to be thought about harder to understand what it was like to live in the period.
Thank you, Robin. As you mentioned, these grand narratives are useful analytical tools for us as we think about and guide students through thinking about periods in the past. As a follow-up question, what are the stakes of allowing these narratives to go unchallenged, especially when, as your article shows, for example, the archaeological record tells a different story?
I think one of the big problems is a lot of our grand narratives are relics of history's past. And a lot of the stories we tell are the same stories that were being told in the 19th century, right? And so in particular, British history was told from the vantage point of imperial history, colonial history. There was a kind of racialist view in these histories. And the Anglo-Saxons, the early people settled in England, are implicated in these racialist narratives. And so if we don't think hard about why we tell the stories that we tell, and we don't think about the history of the histories that we tell, we end up getting trapped in older narratives that perpetuate older sort of racist, imperialist narratives that I think we don't believe anymore.
In a way, this nostalgic imperialism you point towards has been making a comeback in recent decades. I'm thinking, for example, of appeals to the Anglo-Saxons as the foundation of British and even American identity.
And one of the strange things about British history is British history begins in the early 5th century. It doesn't begin in the Roman period, even though the Roman period is a period that generates a lot of written sources. So English history begins with the Anglo-Saxons, and that's a relic of 19th century imperialist and racialist ideologies, right? We just ignore Rome because we don't want to be anybody else's empire. We want to be in charge of things ourselves.
To turn more specifically to your study, you are working in Alton Cemetery. Could you contextualize this cemetery for us?
Sure. So if we look at the evidence that we have now that we didn't have 30 years ago, much of that evidence provided by either new excavations or by the Portable Antiquities Scheme, which is a program that has allowed us to capture a lot of the evidence that is found by amateur metal detectorists. So if we look at that evidence, what we can see is that there's a period in the 5th century when our cemetery was founded in which there are both new people coming in from the continent and lots of people who are related to the old Romano-British population. And so it's within this context of both natives and newcomers that our cemetery is founded.
As I was reading your piece, what was interesting, at least for me, was the focus on individual histories. One way to destabilize these grand narratives is to turn from the macro to the micro. You speak a lot about the agency of the people buried at Alton and how much of their individual histories we can rebuild using the archaeological record. So, can you talk to us a bit about the importance or some of the tensions of extrapolating these macro and micro histories?
So I'm going to start and then I'm going to let Sam finish this. And so for me, I would say, if you think back to the grand narratives and you think about the way one of the grand narratives about barbarian migrations is oftentimes this notion that there are these big war bands on the move, and somehow it's an event rather than something that happens over the course of a couple of hundred years, you miss the individuals who are part of whatever it is that is going on. And so if you look at individuals, and we can tell through new scientific methods whether individuals are moving or not, we have a quite different story. And Sam can speak to what we can tell about migration in this period if we look at individuals rather than the aggregate.
Yeah, no, exactly. So in bioarchaeology, it tends to be dominated by the ancient DNA people, and they often call themselves like pop gen, so population genetics. And they like to look at the really, really big level. And by looking at DNA, you're really looking at sort of the aggregation of people's entire sort of, you know, family tree history. And so I think that often distorts what we're talking about in this period. And I've got a lot of beef with how they tend to frame these narratives. And as a stable isotope person, what I like to look at is those individual narratives. And if individual people within specific cemeteries move during their lifetimes or not, whereas these larger narratives, both historically and in terms of DNA, tend to talk about, you know, huge migrations and big arrows on maps. But we can go, okay, no, this lady buried with these particular brooches moved once, twice, three times in her life. And now we're getting to the resolution where you can say, all right, actually, at the age of 2, she was born near the site. At the age of, say, 7 or 8, she moved away. She moved to somewhere that looked a bit like this. And then by the time she died and was buried back at Alton, you know, she'd sort of moved back again. So we can get these really fine-grained life histories that I think are so much more interesting than just saying XYZ percentage of people were local or non-local. You get that real embodied experience of the past that is so hard to get at in any other way, really.
if you look at whole cemetery populations, what you can see is you can see different people moving at different times. And that's not the grand narrative. The grand narrative is, I don't know, everybody's moving at the same time, right? But what we found is that people over generations are moving into the settlement. What we're finding is lots of women and children are moving in this period. That's really not part of the grand narrative. And so what we begin to see is a lot of individual movement rather than a lot of mass movement. And that's a really different story.
You mentioned brooches, Sam. What other types of objects have you found buried in the graves of Alton Cemetery?
Yeah, I mean, well, Alton's great because it kind of straddles the material culture from the late Roman period through to what we often call Anglo-Saxon or early medieval, whereas a lot of other sites that I've worked on are quite definitively or often talked in, again, these sort of very clear definitions of this as a new material culture. So there's various different types of brooch types, and I'll let Robin sort of tell you more about that because there's some very interesting sort of subtypes there. We've got pottery, weapons. You've really kind of got the whole gamut of things that kind of span the 3rd, 4th centuries through to the 7th.
And there's also one of the nice things about this cemetery, like a lot of early cemeteries, is it's both a inhumation cemetery, so people were burying bodies, but it's also a cremation cemetery as well. So there's lots of interesting pots with the remains of people inside and probably animals as well, but that hasn't been tested yet. So there is a really interesting variety of grave goods. And just as an aside, so I'm going to be working on this material in a couple of weeks in Winchester. And when I was talking to the person who's in charge of the stores at Winchester, he was very afraid that he would have to take a lot of stuff out of the glass cases in the museum where people can look at this stuff. But the only stuff in the glass cases is the stuff that has to do with warfare and men. And there's not a single object that has to do with women or children. So, which is back to the grand narrative, right? I mean, you want your display of Anglo-Saxons to be about guys with swords and you don't want them to be about other things. So I thought that was actually kind of amusing.
That is not surprising. To focus on the human remains for a minute. Sam, you've been talking about the kinds of information that can be extracted from these bodies. Could you talk to us about your process and methods? I'm particularly curious about diets and how you access this kind of information. And please, keep it simple so I can follow along.
Yeah, no, really good question. And I'll try to keep it all nice and family friendly and not get too into the chemistry. Essentially, isotopes are forms of chemical elements, and they've just got slightly different molecular weights, which means that nerds like me can then, you know, measure that. You can measure the weights of them when they come out, but you don't need to worry too much about that. Most people will be kind of familiar with the fact that we're carbon-based life forms. And so carbon is one of the chemical elements we like to hone in on archaeological science because, number one, it allows for radiocarbon dating. Fantastic. That's great. And also carbon 12 and 13 really kind of root us in the landscape. And so it's a really useful thing for looking at diet because it's linked to the bottom of the food chain, the plants that we're eating. And particularly for this period and Alton, it's really useful for us to tell apart some major dietary changes that can happen at the end of the Roman period in particular. And we can talk about, you know, the hows and the whys of that later. But carbon can tell you between particularly sort of marine diets and terrestrial, as well as if people are kind of eating different types of plants that are drought resistant. And then your nitrogen is really linked back to where you are in the food chain. So you might read in the paper where we sort of talk about people having higher nitrogen, meaning they're eating more meat, or sort of lower nitrogen values. And that means they're kind of closer to being modern day vegetarians or vegans. And the way we kind of get at that is you need relatively well preserved bones or teeth. And we want to extract out the collagen. So, you know, people probably, you know, maybe even taking collagen supplements. That's a whole other thing. But, you know, we want that. That's the thing that gives our skin and our bones the elasticity and sort of the bendiness. And that's kind of the best bit to get at for these type of results that you want. So to do that, we have to get rid of the mineral part of the bone that helps you stand up and is the bit that makes it strong. So we dissolve the bones and or your tooth roots, because that's also got collagen in it, in weak acid to make it springy and squishy. So there's a lot of poking bones in acid for weeks on end until they're squishy enough, because you want to do it really gently, right? You don't, these are 1500 year old plus people. You don't want to do it too quickly and have it completely lost in the acid. And then essentially you go through a whole process to then turn that into human soup. and then you freeze dry it and it looks like cotton candy for an American audience. And that's in all of us. That's in your skin, that's in your bones. And that was what we can then look at and put through a mass spec for dietary information, in particular carbon, nitrogen and sulfur, which is linked both to your diet, but also to mobility. And we talk a lot about the sulfur in terms of wet feet and where people are living. And then for mobility, usually apart from sulfur, which is a relatively new technique, we want to look at people's tooth enamel. So that enamel structure locks in the drinking water signatures from the moments that those teeth were being formed. So everyone can probably remember when they were losing different teeth at different times of their life, right? Or when they come through, you know, anyone with kids is kind of imagining the horror of weaning and things. Yeah. But that's really useful for us. Fine resolution from dentistry when these teeth form and things. So we can target, you know, teeth to look at really, really early life. When somebody's, you know, have their third molars, their wisdom teeth coming through, that's kind of the latest snapshot we can get out of your teeth. And then, so I said the oxygen linked to the water, and then strontium is linked to the bedrock that you're living on. You can kind of then imagine, we can sort of add the layers of, are they in sort of a warm climate and you're getting sort of heated water from living somewhere like the Mediterranean, if you're a late Roman who's coming to Britain, or if maybe they've come from somewhere wetter and colder, you know, like the upland areas in Wales or Northern Britain or somewhere else in Europe. And so those are kind of what we can triangulate to then get a picture of where people are living, what they're eating, and that might give you hints as to what cultural background they come from, if they're eating more marine stuff or terrestrial things. There's lots of nuance there, but hopefully that kind of gives you an idea.
And one of the things that Sam does is the denting, where she drills these incremental holes so she can basically see what a person is eating and where they're living every 6 months of life or every year of life for the first 18 years. So that's a level of resolution that you don't get in chronicle sources in the early Middle Ages, right? It says, oh, the king died this year, but it doesn't say anything about, you know, that kind of fine detail of what life was actually like for people. So the resolution is extraordinary.
The king really liked lettuce, for example, I think.
Yeah, he was vegetarian for like these many months.
Something else Sam has found out is that actually kings were pretty vegetarian in this period.
That is interesting. Thank you for that explanation, Sam. Thinking specifically about your work in Alton, you draw attention to 6 case studies. Could you talk to us about why you chose these 6 individuals and go over some of your findings?
Yeah, so we highlighted 3 males and 3 females as sort of some of our key individuals, plus some others scattered throughout that were just really cool that we'll probably bring up in in other parts. Essentially, these 6 people have periods of dietary stress, and that's what we really wanted to highlight as part of this sort of grand narrative, that people often don't talk about, you know, people possibly going through famine or other types of dietary stress that might be linked to illness. What was really interesting for us was the 3 men there all had the exact same sort of stress event starting around 10 to 11 years old. And as far as we can tell at the moment, from the one tooth we've sampled up till when that tooth root finishes at about 15. And this could be obviously famine or something, but the fact that all the men are having it at around the time of sort of starting puberty, that might be, you know, essentially their bodies are really stressed because they're going through a growth spurt or something, right? But the women are really interesting. So all 6 of these people, we sampled the same tooth. So it's the exact same period of late childhood, early adolescence that we're looking at. The women have that same sort of end bit there, 10 to 15, having stress, possibly puberty and other things. Or all 6 of these people could have been going through the same famine, potentially. It's very kind of hard to know at this point if that's the case. But the women have this earlier period of stress that's far more severe than what the men are experiencing. And it's really interesting that it's the women and girls that are experiencing that. And Robin's talked really eloquently in the paper about all the reasons why that might be, you know, for what's going on in this period and gendered access to food. And 2 of those women are by far and away some of the most interesting people in that cemetery from an isotopic point of view. Grave 14 and grave 43 are super, super interesting. And they have this thing called wet feet, which is essentially at periods of their life on those fine grain little slices that Robin was talking about that we do, they get very, very wet, wetter than I've ever seen out of, you know, thousands of samples like this. Those 2 women in particular, and one of them is exquisitely specific. She kind of moves from around about 2.5 years of age, probably living somewhere near Olten to somewhere really, really wet, fenlands, wetlands, basically only capable as far as where around Peterborough in the Fenlands, if anyone kind of knows, north of Cambridge, heading up towards the North Sea and the Wash. And she's a really interesting person, but I'll kind of hand over to Robin for some of that.
And she has, her brooches actually come from that area of the Fenlands too, so it's interesting. But so one of the things that we can see with these women is that they're, you know, the women that we looked at go through two periods of stress, not one. So that's an interesting gender difference. And it could be linked to puberty. It could be linked to migration. So boys are fostered out, we think, at some age that they might be moving household. The women are they being married off? Are they being trafficked? We don't exactly know what's happening, but they're also moving at 12 or 13 or 14. And so the kind of fine grainedness of the story that the isotopes tell allow us to see life cycle in ways that we can't see from the written sources.
One of the cool things about these Speculum Spotlight episodes is that we get to peek behind the curtain and learn about the stuff that doesn't make it into the article. So, how did this interdisciplinary collaboration come about?
I gave a paper on Zoom. I think it was Reading, was it? Reading Archaeology Department. And Sam was in the audience. And I said something about, it was a paper on that I was giving on pottery. And I said something about pottery that interested her because it has the potential of impacting people's oxygen isotopes. So she said, we need to talk. And so we talked and we said, let's collaborate. That's how it happened. Although Sam is known as an uber collaborator, she's not monogamous at all. I mean, she's collaborating, as far as I can tell, with everybody.
Yeah, no, I mean, I just get very excited by other people's papers and data, exactly. And yeah, I mean, that paper that Robin was given just made me went, oh, okay, we need to tackle this. Do you know any particular sites that would be good? Because most of my previous work had been on much later periods for the most part, kind of the 7th century, the conversion period. And I was interested in looking earlier and looking at what was happening. And she went, oh, this one, these pots, let's start here.
And I think, I mean, one of the things that we've decided over time is we're just going to do everything on this cemetery. We're going to isotope everything. We've radiocarbon dated everything. Sam is about to do the peptides on teeth, which will allow us to do a quick and dirty sexing of skeletons, which is much, much cheaper than ADNA, I just say. but we want to do lipids on pots. We want to do everything you can do, not just on the select. What happens oftentimes in cemeteries is that the six people with the nicest jewelry get all the tests. But one of the groups that really interests me are the people without any grave goods at all, or children who tend to not, it's very hard to figure out who they are and what they are. And so by doing everybody, we're going to have a look at this community that I think hasn't been done for any other community.
No, not to this level, I don't think. Yeah.
I've been putting together all the radiocarbon dates that we have. And what our radiocarbon dating shows is that the cemetery began earlier and ended more quickly than the original author of the excavation report thought. Is this life-changing? Well, for those people it is, because we're now actually putting them in their proper chronological context, right? We're not thinking about them in the wrong decades or wrong centuries, but we're thinking about them right where they should be.
I think this project makes a strong case for the importance of cross-disciplinary collaboration for medievalists.
Right. And I'm sure we have different motives for this. One of my motives is I want historians to pay attention to the scientific findings. And they're not going to pay attention to the scientific findings if they're only written by scientists publishing in scientific archaeological journals, right? It's really important for me to write about stuff like this in collaboration, because I wouldn't have a clue how to drill a hole in a tooth, right? It's not what I do. But I can write about it and I can put it in context in a way that historians and lit people might actually pay attention to. So for me, that's a really important thing.
Yeah. And I mean, from my perspective as well, I think the best service you can do to these people is to collaborate with a historian to put them back in that context. And I found that from some of my previous work, it makes it better and it makes the stories more engaging. Otherwise, yeah, you're just kind of talking about graphs and like this one person is a dot over here. You know, there's it's fine that there's a place for that sort of stuff, but I think the methods are at a point now where it's pretty par for the course in bioarchaeology, and some of those papers are relatively dry and boring. And what we really need to be doing to push all of this forward is to collaborate to really get back to that individual and that body and that life course centered approach, rather than just thinking about it all as data clouds in a very vague way.
And if you think about the way that excavation reports of cemeteries are written, they're often written in the aggregate. So you end up getting a description of a cemetery that it's got 200 years worth of evidence, but somehow it's all kind of mushed together. And what it describes is a time and place that never existed, because people in 425 and people in 625 are living in really, really different universes. So imagine reading one of these reports instead, where every individual, instead of just getting their grave goods listed, every individual has a little biography. And you put them in chronological order, and then you make some sense out of both the individuals and the community in which they lived. I mean, it would be a different way of writing this material.
Yes, you are literally humanizing these individuals. So, before we leave, what's next for the project?
Well, Sam's busy right now with a team of master's students and postdocs.
Exactly. Yeah, we've got a small army in the lab at the minute. So like Robin said, trying to do some peptide sexing to work out, particularly for the kids. They're very hard to look at their bones and use osteologists. You kind of can't work out what sex the skeleton is before puberty. So that will be really interesting.
Right. And again, what people did in the past was use grave goods, right? But that's putting somebody's gender expectations on these bodies. And, you know,
exactly.
It's better not to do that. So
yeah, we're hoping to like disentangle all of those things as well, which will be really fantastic. And we're doing a lot of work on the cremations. So that's something that kind of didn't make it into this paper, but we're hoping to kind of bring that out. So again, we can't sort of work out what they're eating, because when they get burnt, all of that nice collagen goes bye-bye. But we're doing radiocarbon dating and some other isotopes to work out if these people were any more mobile than the people who were buried full body with stuff. And then hopefully also doing residues on the pots, both from the cremations and ones in with the inhumations, to work out what was cooked in there and if some of these funerary urns are just for the funeral, or if it was, you know, you bury grandma in her favorite cooking pot or
cooking.
Yeah.
Yeah, bury me in my Dutch oven.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Sam, Robin, thank you for joining us today to discuss your article.
Well, thanks for doing it. We're always happy to talk about our work.
Thanks so much. It's been great.
Many thanks to John, Robin, and Sam for this fascinating conversation. You can read their article, Rethinking Grand Narratives, Mobility, Diet, and Health in a Small Corner of Early Medieval Hampshire, free of charge on the Speculum website at the University of Chicago Press. Let me also thank the Multicultural Middle Ages team, Will Beatty, Lauren Lee, Rita Mara, Logan Quigley, and Jonathan Correa-Reyes. In addition, I want to thank the Speculum Editorial Board, staff members Taylor McCall, Carol Anderson, and Esther German, the Graduate Committee of the MAA, and the Medieval Academy itself for co-sponsoring this podcast. Music for the MMA is by Anna O'Connell. I'm Barbara Newman, editor of Speculum, the Journal of the Medieval Academy of America, published by the University of Chicago Press. If you join the Medieval Academy, you will receive a subscription to both print and digital editions. Online, you can find us at journals.uchicago.edu. We'll be back in October with the next episode of Speculum Spotlight.